Welcome to On Background here on WKXL 1.9, 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com, a comprehensive show that takes a look at politics here in the great state of New Hampshire and across the country. I am Chris Ryan along with Paul Steinhauser, the show presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you, the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Of course, the big story in politics is the victory of Doug Jones down in Alabama, a victory for a Democrat in a predominantly red state, a victory for a Democrat in a state where Republicans outnumbered Democrats 2-1 in terms of registered voters. Paul, this was a significant victory, obviously, for Democrats against a very flawed Republican candidate. But even with those, even knowing that, it was an uphill climb for Jones to win this election.
It was, and it was all about organization. It was all about momentum, and we're going to get into all that. But give credit to Doug Jones and his campaign, plus the Democrats nationally who quietly went down to Alabama and helped out. Also, what does this do? This changes now the makeup of the U.S. Senate. The Republican majority goes from 52-48 to 51-49. Jones will have this seat at least through the 2020 election. So this is a huge, huge victory for Democrats, and in a way, it'll only embolden them as they move towards 2018. It'll only make them feel like the Democratic wave that they perceive is coming is getting bigger and bigger.
It'll be interesting to see, you know, how Republicans react to this, and we'll have reaction from some Republicans here in the Granite State in just a little bit here on the program. Paul talks with Jeanne Forrester. I talk with Tom Rath about what they think about what took place in Alabama. But first, let's hear from Doug Jones at his victory party.
We have been at crossroads in the past, and unfortunately, we have usually taken the wrong fork. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, you took the right road.
All right, Doug Jones, the former prosecutor, was overwhelmed by the victory. He said that the Alabama campaign was about dignity, respect, and common decency. And I would agree with that. The baseline here in this election was whether or not Alabama wanted to send Roy Moore to the United States Senate, and African-Americans, independents, and Republicans, to a large enough degree, said no. And as a result, Doug Jones is headed to the United States Senate. He says this election shows the people of Alabama are united.
I am truly, truly overwhelmed. But you know, folks, and you have all heard me say this at one point or another in this campaign, I have always believed that the people of Alabama had more in common than to divide us.
You know, Chris, what's interesting, if you look at the percentage of people who voted but actually wrote in another candidate, it was more the people than the margin of Jones's victory over Moore, which was about 15,000 votes. And it just shows there were a lot of Republicans that just held their nose or didn't hold their nose, I mean, and voted. They couldn't vote for Doug Jones, a Democrat, but they could not vote for Roy Moore. And that was also one of the differences besides the huge turnout of African-Americans and college-educated whites as well. So a number of factors here. Republicans are saying, listen, we had an extremely flawed candidate. This is a one-off. This is not going to impact us in 2018. And I had a chance to talk about that with Jeanne Forrester, the chair right here in New Hampshire for the Republican GOP.
I don't believe that it will have legs here in New Hampshire. Look, you know, we've got a governor who's got a 62% approval rating. 75% of the people polled in New Hampshire believe we're headed in the right direction. You know, I like to tell folks, you know, look, we're New Hampshire Republicans. We're getting things done. We know how to work across the aisle. And we've got a governor who's very popular. So I think Chris is in a good position.
That's Paul Steinhauser with Jeanne Forrester. I talked with Tom Rath, of course, former attorney general and a individual who has had key roles in numerous presidential campaigns and the year of presidents and presidential nominees.
I actually think if this race was not a special election, if this race had occurred in November, Moore probably would have won. The ability of everybody to concentrate on one race and quite honestly, the inherent flaws in the candidacy of Moore. I mean, the arrogance of a guy like Moore with that kind of a background to sort of foist himself off on the Republican Party, and he's done it, he's tried several times, and then to have it compounded by Bannon going down there and saying this is the way of the future, they underestimate the decency of the American voter, the American citizen. And so, yeah, there are a lot of externals we can kind of play, you know, political strategist or political scientist on this. The fact is they underestimated how decent Alabama was and how it empowered certain parts of that electorate, particularly the African-American part, have been since the post-presidency of Barack Obama. They're not just going to sit back and take it. And I think this was a great victory for them.
I agree. I think it was a victory for honor, decency, integrity, and in my view, I talk about it a lot, how individuals should choose candidates. You should look at the candidates. You should look at the individuals, not the R or the D,
right,
but make the determination based upon the values, the ability to serve in the office that they're pursuing. And this election came down to turnout, but it was also an election about Roy Moore. And unlike the presidential election, the alternative was Doug. And Doug was Doug. There was no, it was like Doug didn't have any baggage.
I think that's very much right. I think people forget that voters tend to be possessive of these seats. They only have two of them, and they don't give them away easily. Yeah. They don't want them to go to quote-unquote carpetbaggers. They want them to go to people who sort of are not just from the community but of the community. And Jones checked off those boxes. Moore certainly was from Alabama, but he was represented in Alabama that probably doesn't exist anymore.
That's a very good point.
And the nastiness.
And that a lot of people didn't necessarily want to see brought back.
Right, exactly right. And the thing that I thought was very ironic, I know people have been making a lot of it today, was that when Bannon went down there, he made fun of Joe Scarborough.
Right.
And he said, I got into Harvard and he had to go to the University of Alabama. Now, that county, Tuscaloosa County, had gone for in the last election, had gone for Trump by 29 points. And it went for Jones by 16.
Right.
So there was a 35-point swing right where the University of Alabama is. But that tells you that people pay attention, they know what's going on, and they don't take these things lightly.
Well, there you go. Two very different perspectives from two top Republicans here in the Grand Estate about what the Alabama results mean going into 2018 nationally, and, of course, more importantly for us, here in New Hampshire. What about the Democrats? Well, guess what? The top Democrat in the State House of Representatives was in Alabama, helping the Doug Jones campaign. And we will speak with Steve Shurtleff in a moment when On Background continues.
New Hampshire's nursing home residents receive the best care in the nation thanks to caregivers such as Sheila from Pleasant View Center in Concord.
I enjoy getting to know each of our residents. You know, there are nights when I go home and think about how I can help them overcome challenges and live a better life.
Quality care requires caregivers focused on residents, not personal financial struggles. The New Hampshire Healthcare Association fights for fair Medicaid funding so residents can receive quality care from caregivers earning a livable wage.
Your body is a unique design with its own nutritional needs, which are generated through eating a healthy diet and built upon with the right high-quality supplements. At the Prescription Center in Concord, let their natural pharmacy consultant lead you through this often confusing maze of choosing the best high-end supplements for your condition. Again, that's at the Prescription Center here in Concord. For more information, you can call their toll-free number at 1-800-870-7063 or check out their website, which is prescription-center.com. The Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first.
Welcome back. This is On Background here on WKXL 1-9, 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com, which is presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. The New Hampshire Healthcare Association. For information, go to NHHCA.org. Steve Shurtleff was on the ground in Alabama campaigning for Doug Jones and was in key districts in Birmingham. And one of the keys to this election was how the African-American vote came out in larger numbers than expected for Doug Jones. Steve, welcome to the program.
Oh, just great, Chris.
Appreciate joining us for the program. A lot of times in elections, you'll hear about there being an energy on the ground or a feeling that an election is going to sway in a certain direction based upon what you're feeling. And you were in key areas in Birmingham and around Birmingham where the focus for the Jones campaign was bringing out the African-American vote, which they were able to do to a great extent. You were able to do to a great extent. What type of sense did you get about the election results when you were on the ground?
Well, you know, I was in two different communities. I was in Bessemer, Alabama, in a town by the name of Irondale, Alabama. And both areas were predominantly black communities. And going door to door and asking people to come out to vote, you know, the responses I got from people, it was just tremendous. You know, they would tell you with pride, absolutely, I'll be at the polls on election day. I'm not going to miss this election. And, you know, the candidate, Doug Jones, had a lot of respect in the black community as being the one to finally prosecute the four individuals that bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in 1963, killing four little black girls. And Doug Jones never made an issue of it in the campaign. There was no talk of it in the campaign. But especially those in the black community knew what a champion he was to avenge those terrible deaths. And I think that inspired a lot of people that may have said, well, it's just one vote, you know, one election, to actually come out and vote for Doug Jones.
You know, Steve, traditionally black voters in Alabama vote for Democrats. That didn't change in the election. What did change was the percentage. They made up 29% of the electorate down there, according to the exit polls in Alabama.
Right.
They were energized. I guess when they saw Steve Shirtliff on the ground in Alabama, that must have energized them even more.
Yeah. It's usually known as the Shirtliff bump. And, but you're right, though, Paul. They're hoping for a 25% turnout in the black communities for Doug Jones, and the number was closer to 29.
Mm-hmm.
And it's somewhat unique here in Alabama. You've got to have a state-issued ID to vote on election day. And you get them at Department of Motor Vehicles. And a couple of years ago here in Alabama, they closed 31 motor vehicle substations, and most of those are in black communities. In the last election, they saw a 5% downturn in voter turnout in black neighborhoods, and some of they felt was over this ID issue. So to see that almost 30% turnout was truly incredible.
Obviously, you were a volunteer during this campaign, so I'm sure that you don't have access to the direct thinking that existed amongst the Jones campaign hierarchy. But when we talked about you going down there, we looked at the polls and saw that Roy Moore was winning 4-5%. And
right.
to me, this effort in the predominantly African-American communities to draw out individuals who were not being polled. In other words, to work beyond the models in this election and to increase voter turnout in areas that weren't expected to have an increase was where this was going to be won for Doug Jones. Did you see that as being the strategy, and were there other groups of volunteers who were in other African-American communities across the state of Alabama who had the same focus that that your group did?
I can just speak more about Birmingham. It seemed that way that, I had one lady tell me in Bessemer, she said, you know, it's so nice to have somebody come to my door and for you being here to ask us to come vote. And, you know, this is a very red state, and so they don't have a lot of contested Democratic Republican races. It's pretty much one-sided. And so there hasn't been a lot of activity by Democrats statewide. But this Doug Jones campaign really took off. And we had the people here in Alabama that could go to neighborhoods that haven't seen Democrats canvassing and to say and tell people, you know, your vote is so important. It means so much. You've got to come out on election day. And they appreciated that little extra effort and to come to their home and say, please, you know, please vote. It meant a lot.
Hey, Steve, Alabama's pretty far from New Hampshire, but
this
race got a ton of national attention. So people here in New Hampshire, more than very aware of what was going on. So bring it home for us. What is the impact of this Alabama election here in New Hampshire in the contest coming up in 2018? Does this help you when it comes to recruitment? Does this even further energize Democrats in this state as you try to retake the chamber?
Well, you know, I think it shows that the people of Alabama, when it came to Judge Moore, you know, said this politics of bigotry and racism, we're just not going to tolerate it anymore. And this was not a Democratic victory. It was a victory by the people of Alabama, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, who said, you know, enough is enough. Doug Jones won in Huntsville, and he won in Mobile, which were traditionally Republican strongholds, because Republicans said, you know, we'll tolerate so much, but there comes a time when some of those to the extreme right have gone too far, and this is one of those times. And I think referring to New Hampshire, I think there's an element within the Republican Party and the Granite State that is trying to take the party a little more to the right than a lot of people want to see. In New Hampshire, is pretty much a centrist state. There'll be a little to the right on some things and a little to the left maybe on something else, but it's a moderate state.
But do you see this the election at all helping Democrats in the state, at least when it comes to enthusiasm maybe, and when it comes to candidate recruitment?
I do. You know, I've heard from a lot of people in our own caucus that have emailed me and how excited they are, and I think it bodes well for New Hampshire. And I think, as a lot of analysts have said, there may be a tide coming in 18, which might be very good for Democrats.
I think that you make a key point in regards to the America that so many folks believe in. And the Democratic Party is in shambles, really, at the national level at this point in terms of its operational status, as well as difficulties in fundraising. But at the grassroots level, it's a very different story, where the Republican Party is being viewed as the party of Donald Trump amongst independents, or even some Republicans who are moderates, and they don't recognize this Republican Party that Steve Bannon and Donald Trump have thrust upon them. And because of our system, there are only two parties. So the natural beneficiary is going to be the Democratic Party. And if the Republican Party is going to be defined as one of limited opportunity for folks who are not Caucasian, who do not have certain mindsets and ideology, and that the Democratic Party is allowed to become this huge tent for all individuals, we're going to start to see individuals who want to stake their claim in America again, who feel that their identities have been challenged. They're going to step forward, and they're not going to be comfortable in stepping forward in the Republican Party. They're going to do so as independents, or going to do so as Democrats. So now, this has been the case for a number of years now. It is incumbent upon the Republicans who are moderates, who believe in problem solving, who believe in a America that is one for all individuals, to reclaim the Republican Party from Steve Bannon and Donald Trump, or Democrats are going to have a lot of victories, not just in 2018, but moving forward, just purely based upon demographics.
That's a great point, Chris. And to me, one of the heroes of this race here in Alabama was Senator Richard Shelby, who over the weekend said, "I'm not voting for Doug Jones, but then again, I'm not voting for Roy Moore either. I'm going to write in the name of a good Republican." And there were 22,000 write-in votes. Well, that was the margin of Doug Jones's victory. And I think it's people like Senator Shelby that said, you know, we're sick and tired of the people on the extremes telling us, you know, how our party should function and what we should believe in and what our philosophy is. And I've seen that in New Hampshire, in the New Hampshire House. We've had some wonderful moderate Republicans be challenged in primaries and have those on the extreme right refer to them as rhinos, Republican in name only, that they weren't pure enough. And I think we're going to see some of that fall by the wayside and more moderate Republicans running for the New Hampshire House, which is good for the state.
Hey, Steve, before we let you go, I know you're hopping on a flight back here. You told me the other day that you missed, for one of the few rare times ever, a Concord City Council meeting.
Right.
While you were going, it looks like they're raising the price on the parking meter, so you better get back here now.
I know. That's why I'm cutting this trip short and getting back and seeing what's going on in the capital city.
Well, Steve Shirtless, Chris, is a modest man, but I really think he was the reason the African-American vote was so big and so large and so energized down there in Alabama. Now, seriously, though, and you heard it from Shirtless, and I also spoke to some other Democratic operatives in this state, they really do think that even though this was Alabama, it could have an impact here in New Hampshire when it comes to fundraising, when it comes to candidate recruitment, and just overall energy and enthusiasm heading into some crucial 2018 contest. Well, coming up next, we're going to shift gears and we're going to talk to New Hampshire's senior U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen about a host of topics, including whether Donald Trump needs to maybe think about resigning. Stay tuned. On Background continues in a moment. We'll be right back.
This is On Background here on 1039, 1450, and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I'm Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program. On Background is presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. The New Hampshire Healthcare Association. For information, go to nhhca.org. Well, Paul Steinhauser and I hit the road on this edition of the program, heading all the way down to Hooksett, New Hampshire at Southern Hampshire University to talk with U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen. A number of key topics that we discussed with her, including tax reform, as well as whether or not the President of the United States should resign based upon his the accusations against him in regards to sexual assault. Very interesting interview with U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen. And, oh, of course, at the end as well, we brought up whether or not she's going to run for re-election herself in 2020. Have a listen.
Senator Jeanne Shaheen, as she discusses the tax reform plan and the impact it's going to have on students here in New Hampshire and across the country, in your view, is there a danger for Democrats in not presenting an alternative to tax reform and presenting alternative ideas as opposed to just discussing what's wrong with the Republican plan?
No, I think there have been a lot of alternative ideas presented, and I think there is bipartisan support for tax reform, but it's for tax reform that will help middle-income families that would be paid for so that we're not adding over $1 trillion to the national debt, and tax reform that is not going to adversely impact the future workforce of this country and the research and innovation that we need to do in America to grow the economy. And that's what this conversation was about this morning. It was listening to students who are teaching in classrooms at UNH, who are doing cutting-edge research that we need. They're going to go to corporations, to small businesses. They're going to stay in classrooms, and they're going to be the future of America. And if we make changes so that they can no longer afford to be in graduate school, if we can no longer afford for companies to further educate their employees, that's going to have a huge impact on the economy.
I ask that because of this. When President Trump and Republicans run for re-election, they're going to take tax reform and say, okay, you don't like this part of the tax reform. That's because Democrats wouldn't work with us, and that's because they didn't offer any alternatives. And the tax reform would be better, and it would help more middle-class folks if that were the case.
That's just baloney, Chris. The fact is, this tax reform package was passed in the middle of the night. There was not one public hearing. It was done behind closed doors with no effort to get input from Democrats who, you know, I stood on the floor of the Senate and said, I want to work with my colleagues. So many Democrats did to say, let's get bipartisan tax reform that will help middle-income families, that will lower the corporate rate, that is paid for. We could have done all of those things. But this insistence that we are going to have a tax proposal that is going to provide thousands of dollars to the upper income folks in this country, that's going to cut corporate tax rates in a way that most corporations have said they're not going to reinvest those dollars in their employees or in the economy. That's just crazy.
The Republicans right now are controlling the conference committee on this tax bill. Do the Democrats have any say in it?
No, not really. The interesting thing about the Committee of Conference is that the House and the Senate conferees are not agreeing right now, but Democrats are essentially cut out.
It's going to be a close vote. Susan Collins, your friend from right over the border in Maine, she's wavering right now, and I'm wondering, have you had any conversations with her in recent days and maybe trying to bring her to your side?
I haven't had a conversation with her since before the bill was passed.
I'm curious as well, you know, in terms of the policy side of things, there have been a lot of opportunities for substantive policy on infrastructure, on health care, to be worked on in a bipartisan fashion. Is there a particular kind of swing and miss, or just a swing perhaps, that has occurred during the course of the Trump administration that you think should have been worked on?
Well, certainly infrastructure. We all thought that that was going to be the first piece of legislation that we were going to talk to the White House about. The president indicated that we could spend $1 trillion on infrastructure investment. I think we would have supported that. We could have done it with a public-private partnership. We could have done it in so many ways, and yet we still haven't heard anything from the White House about that. And we need not just help with our roads and bridges in New Hampshire, but with broadband, with cell phone coverage, with water systems and sewage treatment systems. It's a huge issue in this state and across the country, and something Democrats and Republicans can all agree on.
Final thing on tax reform, and move on to something else. I'm curious in your view as to why you think Republicans have developed this particular tax plan, which the baseline is, will this help the middle class, as opposed to, you know, arguing about, well, it doesn't help the middle class enough, or it affects the middle class too positively. Obviously, the majority of Americans are middle class. The individuals who voted for President Trump are largely working class and middle class. Why, in your view, have Republicans set the tax reform baseline where they have?
Well, they've said very clearly, we've had a number of people comment, that we're doing this for our donors, for the people who have funded Republicans for elective office. And just to give people listening some idea, this tax proposal that came out of the Senate would give the 572,000 Americans who make over $1 million a year a $59,000 tax cut. For the 90 million Americans who make $50,000 or less, they will get a $106 tax cut, about $7.50 per pay period. And after 2027, if you're making up to $75,000 a year, you're going to get a tax increase for most people. So this is not help for people who really need it, who are struggling, like the students we heard from today. One young man said, you know, I'm engaged. I really want to get out, get married, buy a house. And because I'm looking at a student loan debt, that's going to be really hard for me to do. Well, that's what we ought to be thinking about in terms of stimulating the economy. How can we look across the economy and help people who have been struggling, who need help?
Your colleague from Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders, just made some headlines suggesting that President Trump should consider stepping down because of the past allegations of sexual misconduct. He joins Senator Booker and Senator Merkley from Maine. And I'm wondering, I asked Senator Hassan about this as well, what you think about that. Should the president consider stepping down?
Well, I think the president made it very clear that he wasn't going to do that. I think there are other concerns about this president with respect to violations of the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution, where he and his family are getting financially benefited from his time in office. You know, the estimates that I've seen about this tax proposal are that the Trump family would benefit up to $1 billion from this tax proposal, while, as I said, most middle-income Americans are going to see very little benefit. I don't think that's the kind of tax reform we need in this country.
You're not the best person to ask about this, because you didn't call for Senator Franken's resignation because of your role on the Ethics Committee. But there's so many senators like Bernie Sanders, your colleague Senator Hassan, will fall short of calling for the president to resign. Even Bernie Sanders didn't exactly ask for him to resign. Why do you think that senators are willing to go out and say Senator Franken should resign for his behavior, but when there's credible allegations against the President of the United States, they are not willing to take that next step, or even you weren't willing to take the next step here in regards to asking for his resignation?
Well, I think the voters have elected him, and that's one of the challenges. But because I'm on the Ethics Committee, I'm prohibited from commenting on any specific case that may come before the committee in the Senate. So I've been very careful about what I've said.
Democratic National Committee, the Unity Commission, just making some news, calling for scrapping about 60% of the superdelegates, of which you're one of, and for most of the remainder of those delegates, tying their vote for the nominee to basically the results of the states. Good idea, bad idea?
I think if that's what people decide to do, then that's fine. My experience has been that when you try and manipulate the presidential selection process in the parties to benefit a particular candidate, that often backfires. So I think we need more discussion. We need to see what we think the impact would be. But if that's what people decide to do, you know, I think I certainly am fine with that.
Final thing, I want to ask you about 2020. Not if you're running for President of the United States, but if you are, you can let me know, and that would be a good thing. But obviously, that is your reelect year, 2020, and we're, you know, staring that down, obviously, 2018 right around the corner. There's been a lot of rumors, shall we say, in political circles about what your future is going to hold, if you're going to run again, if you're not going to run again. You're probably not going to give me a direct answer about this.
You're right, I'm not.
But so where are you at in terms of the thought process? Like, do you have a timeline or anything?
No. I'm focused on, you know, what I need to do in Washington. I'm focused on what New Hampshire needs, and I'm focused on 2018 and trying to take back the Senate and Congress in 2018, because I think that will be an important message to signal this president and the country about what we need to be investing in the future.
Do you enjoy being a United States Senator? You've talked before about, particularly in your first term, about the frustrations where you're governor and you could do certain things as a senator. There was a different pace, shall we say, as compared to the way things work in New Hampshire. You obviously gained, you know, more seniority, which has allowed for more opportunities this term. Do you enjoy being a senator?
Of course. It's been a tremendous honor to be able to represent the people of New Hampshire and to be able to make a difference for people. People like some of these students today who feel like there's somebody who is really going to be out there on their side trying to address the concerns they have as they try and finish their education, get into the job market, and deal with their student loans. So absolutely.
Chris, yeah, it was a great candid interview we got there with the senator, though, as she said, she wouldn't give us a direct answer on 2020. It's early, and we can start really bugging her about that the second after the 2018 midterms are over, because right now she can kind of hide behind that it's all about the 2018, getting Democrats elected. I will say this, though, it was interesting a couple months ago when Shaheen came out in support of Bernie Sanders' single-payer Medicare for All plan. People read it two different ways. A lot of operatives said, hey, this is a sign. Jean Shaheen is running again in 2020. That's why she's moving even further to the left. Others are saying, no, she's not running, and now she's free to say whatever she wants, and this is what she really thinks. So two very different takes on whether she will or won't run again in 2020. Again, you and I will be asking her over and over, maybe 6 or 9 months from now.
When we return here on Background on 1039, 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com, Paul Steinhauser and I take a look at the 2020 New Hampshire primary. Has a Democratic candidate emerged from a pack of candidates as a potential frontrunner? I say yes. We'll see what Paul Steinhauser thinks about the big week for Kirsten Gillibrand. We return here on Background on 1039, 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. On Background is presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background here on 1039, 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I'm Chris Ryan along with the great Paul Steinhauser. And in this segment of the program, we'll take a look at 2018 on the Democratic governor's side of things. As Paul talked with Steve Marchand and I talked with Dan Feltes, who made public the fact that he is considering a run for governor on my New Hampshire Now program earlier this week, after Paul talked to sources close to Dan Feltes about whether or not the senator from Concord was going to run. But before we get to that, the biggest winner of this week was an individual who was actually the subject to some really inappropriate, in my view, language and overtones from the President of the United States on Twitter, and that is United States Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. To me, Democrats have been looking for a figure, a key figure to rally around, someone who is going to emerge as, you know, the leader of this resist movement and, you know, eventually, you know, perhaps run against Donald Trump for the presidency of the United States. And it appears, in my view, that Kirsten Gillibrand is stepping forward to be that individual. She is distancing herself from the Clintons, pushing them into the past, stepping forward, and is now going this week toe-to-toe with the President of the United States.
Sexual harassment is a great issue for her. It's something that she's fought the U.S. military in her last 10 years in the U.S. Senate, trying to open it up and make it easier for females in the military to report sexual harassment. So it's an issue that she's been battling on for a number of years, and now she's just kind of just paying it forward, I guess you could say, on this one. Listen, she's definitely raised her stature here. She was the first U.S. Democratic Senator senator to call on Al Franken to resign. You're right, she's also pushed back against Bill Clinton, saying if he was president right now and the Lewinsky matter came up, he should have thought about resigning as well. And that angered a lot of people in the Clinton camp. And now the first calls on Donald Trump to resign. So she's definitely raising her stature. And Chris, this all comes as we now kind of, you know, get into the early preseason of the 2020 race for the White House. This definitely raises her stature. She's on that large list of maybe 15 or 20 Democrats who's considering a run for the 2020 Democratic nomination. I think we'll take her a lot more seriously now.
I agree. And you know, I think that the next Democratic candidate for president is going to have to be an individual who has created clear separation between themselves and the Clintons, which she is obviously doing.
Check.
Yep, she's checked that off. And a person who can stand toe-to-toe with Donald Trump and win arguments with him. And this was a huge, you know, few weeks for her. And you can look at, you know, the positioning in regards to the Clintons. She took over Hillary Clinton's U.S. Senate seat when Clinton became Secretary of State. She has sought the endorsements and financing and fundraising apparatus from the Clintons in the past. So it's a difficult break for her, as you're referencing earlier, but it's a break that needed to take place. And the next Democratic candidate for president, you know, needs to be one that is separated from the past and is looking clearly forward. As we saw in the tweet from Donald Trump, there is going to be an attempt on his part to label whoever is the Democratic nominee as being, you know, a Clinton-type figure, because he has seen, as Republicans have seen for the last 25 years, that the Clintons are good for business in drawing Republicans to donate to campaigns and drawing Republicans to vote in elections.
I thought it was telling that she pushed back immediately after Donald Trump's controversial tweet aimed right at her. And it was also telling that Elizabeth Warren, the liberal senator from Massachusetts, who was also probably mulling a 2020 Democratic nomination bid, also came to her defense, to Gillibrand's defense, and attacked the president. And let's also be honest, Bernie Sanders, who's probably seriously mulling another bid for the Democratic nomination, last week also called on or urged the president to consider resigning over these multiple allegations of sexual misconduct. So a bunch of these potential 2020 contenders raising their stature, but definitely give the award this week to Kirsten Gillibrand.
An individual who is not mulling running for office is Steve Marchand. Marchand has...
Not the White House.
he is running for office. He has been running for office for a very long period of time. It seems like, and in fact, he has been running for office almost since Chris Sununu became governor.
Mm-hmm.
And he continues to do so, largely in the backdrop, building a grassroots network of supporters, meeting one-on-one with folks in coffee shops and living rooms across the state in hopes of becoming governor in 2018. And you talked with him.
I sure did. Listen, he announced his bid back in early April, which is probably the earliest anybody has ever announced a bid for governor here in New Hampshire, more than a year and a half before the election. He's been doing my article in the Concord Monitor was Marchand's under the radar bid for governor. He's doing what he needs to be doing right now. It's not sexy. It's not getting a lot of media attention. I caught up with him early on a Friday night in East Derry, where he was at a house party with maybe 15 or 20 Democrats. But he's working it the hard way. Take a listen.
We're just going to continue to do our work. I think we have built on a very promising campaign last year. We only ran for about 3 months actively as a candidate last year. Spent, I think, under $100,000 and still got a quarter of the vote, and we're moving up like a rocket at the end. So we built off of that, and I feel very good as long as we continue to do the work we're doing. We got the right message. We got the right work ethic. We're going to have the money, and we've taken advantage of the extra time. So I feel very good about where we're at right now.
Not a lot of media attention. This is a campaign that's mostly under the radar right now. Are you frustrated about that, or no? Is that where it should be right now?
It was an early start. We had some exciting local elections, and clearly that was going to take a lot of energy and attention, media attention in 2017, justifiably so. The work we've done has been the ultimate in grassroots. I mean, my attitude is, if people expect John McCain or Barack Obama to come to your living room before you're going to commit to them, then who the heck am I? We're running for governor. You should earn it in that kind of way. So we've done about 145 events so far this year, and we grind it out, you know, 20 to 50 people at a time typically. It's been highly successful. Then they end up doing events after that. Second and third generation already of events in many towns. Got supporters in about 200 different towns, public supporters. And we build off of that. So it was never anticipated to be something that would be big and sexy the year and a half before the election. You do the work now, and we're seeing the fruit of that labor already.
That is Paul Steinhauser with Steve Marchand. An individual mulling a run for office is Dan Feltes. It was announced by Paul and reported by Paul early last week that, in fact, State Senator Dan Feltes is considering running for office, and he confirmed that on my New Hampshire Now program. Have a listen to that.
Well, look, you know, Aaron and I got into this to begin with in terms of public service and helping more people as a legal aid lawyer. Prior to serving in the state Senate, I was helping people, low to middle income families in court, seniors, veterans in court, administrative agencies, and occasionally at the state house advocating on issues that affect working families. And one of the things I noticed is the absence of, you know, to some degree, in the folks with the orange badges, people representing so-called the public interest. And what I wanted to do and what Aaron wanted to do, and that's why we ran for state senate to begin with, is to help represent this district and help represent the values and the issues that really mean expanding opportunity for everyone, not just those at the top. And that's what it's been about, and that's what we've worked hard at, continue to work hard at. Certainly some folks have encouraged take a look at that opportunity potentially. But Aaron and I are, you know, thinking about number of things, and certainly we'll make a decision sometime in early 2018 about the election in 2018.
What has the reaction been from individuals here in Concord, individuals that you know, perhaps some that you don't know, to the, you know, announcement, if you will, that you were interested in running? What has the reaction been like?
Well, I mean, first, it wasn't really an announcement, but there was obviously reporting considering this among, you know, other options, including running for state senate and including not running. And obviously the reaction has been generally positive. I mean, people, I think, want to change in the corner office, with a governor who is focused on, in my view anyway, and in some people's view, a budget that gives even more tax breaks to the wealthiest and the big corporations, many of which with headquarters out of state.
You mentioned, in this final thing on the governorship, and then we'll move on to some other issues, but you mentioned, you know, the rationale that you're going through and the thought process that you're going through. But there's also the political side of things. As I've mentioned, this election is, in my view, an election that is winnable for Democrats, but is going to be a difficult one in retaining the corner office. So from the political side of things and your future, you obviously have a desire for public service. You have a desire to be governor of the state of New Hampshire. How does that weigh on things?
Well, I have a desire to make, and Aaron has a desire to make, a biggest, most positive impact on working families and helping expand opportunity for everyone, not just those at the top. And I think there's a lot of work to do regardless of what folks run for, regardless of what, you know, the horse race stuff next fall. Right now, we have a lot of work to do. We have work to do to come together on a bipartisan Medicaid expansion to make sure that we reauthorize health care for over 50,000 grandstanders.
Great stuff there, Chris. Here's what I find fascinating. Dan Feltes and Colin Van Oosteren, who's also seriously mulling a bid for the Democratic nomination, that would be his second run if he does, they're good friends. They talk a lot. My hunch is this. One of them will run. Both of them will not run. There will be more than just Steve Marchand in this bid for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination in 2018. Could be Feltes, could be Van Oosteren, but I'm pretty sure one of them is going to run. Stay tuned. It's going to be interesting.
And I think that there will be 3 to 4 candidates who will run overall. I agree with you that Feltes and Van Oosteren will not run at the exact same time. But Mark Connelly is still a potential candidate, and I think there'll be a surprise as well. Another great edition of On Background here on WKXL 1059, 1450, and ConcordNewsRadio.com. On Background, a comprehensive look at politics in the Granite State, is presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Check them out at nhhca.org, helping those who help you. The New Hampshire Healthcare Association. For Paul Steinhauser, I am Chris Ryan. Have a great rest of the day, everybody.